Hey, fellow horror fans. This is Troy Escamilla, the director of Party Night and Mrs. Claus, and you are listening to Anthony T's Horror Show. Enjoy.
Welcome to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm Anthony T. This episode is going to be an interview show. First, I'm going to talk with Crest Winchester from ScareCon New England, as we're going to talk about the ScareCon New England Podcaster Awards. Then I'm going to talk to actress, writer, and director Jessica Cameron as we talk about her two latest films, Save Yourself and The Song of Solomon. And I'll have a film recommendation of a film that, well, Joe Bob Briggs recently trashed on The Last Drive-In. Now, before I get to the news and everything, I want to apologize for the excessive language I used last episode. I admit, I kind of got off the rails, and I got too carried away with the language, in which I truly apologize for, as I didn't mean to cause any trouble or anything. And from now on, I'll try to keep the show more PG, PG-13, as I'm still new to podcasting, and I kind of did not know my audience. Now I have a better grasp of who my audience is, and I will tone down the language and try to stay PG as much as possible. You may get a swear here or there, which I will warn you right now, that may not be suitable for young viewers when we get to my interview with Jessica Cameron. And no, I did not swear, but I figured I'd warn you right now, so I don't get any complaints, and it wasn't me that swore. So I figured I'd let you all know up front. During my interview with Jessica Cameron, there may be some language that may not be suitable for young viewer listeners. I also have a disclaimer right before the interview as well, so you know when to turn off for the younger listeners. Okay, with that out of the way, let's start off with the news. This is going to be a very brief one here this episode because we have two guests on. And since I have convention news to share, I figured, which story should I talk about? Because there was like a couple of them. I could talk about MGM wanting to remake Poltergeist now. But I'll save that for next episode, as I'm going to have a nice open letter for MGM. Studio of Remakes. Because basically, they just want to remake things now. It's like, whatever. I'll save that for episode 19. I could talk about the reboot of The Craft by Blumhouse. I'll save that one too, because I don't know if it's going to be a reboot, a sequel, or a remake. It just confuses me if they're going to have totally different characters. So I'm going to table that until there's more definite information on that. But the thing I'm going to talk about that really made me happy, Full Moon Features is doing some Species 5. Yes, I said it. Full Moon Features is doing Subspecies 5. Now, if you don't count the Vampire Journals, which is basically a spinoff of Subspecies, we haven't had a Subspecies film in 20 years. Because Full Moon's films have basically been very low budget films ever since they left Paramount Pictures back in the late 90s. But this to me, it's a big deal. Because Full Moon Features has been pretty much part of my horror life. I've been seeing these films from Charles Band, whether it's directing or producing, since about 1994, 1995. So when I heard this news, I was so excited because I always loved the subspecies saga. And I was really hoping they would make another film because the last film, Subspecies Bloodstorm, wasn't that great. But I'm really hoping Subspecies 5 is a very good film. They also announced that Anders Hove is coming back. So that's another thing that's exciting about the Subspecies 5. I don't know what the film is going to be, as it's part of a supposed Deadly 10 series that Full Moon Features is running, which details will be announced very soon. So it'll be interesting to see if there's more details on Subspecies 5 once the whole Deadly 10 project gets announced. But this has got me excited, because I haven't been excited for a Full Moon film probably since Trophy Heads, which came out 5 years ago and starred Linnea Quigley, Brink Stevens, Michelle Bauer, Denise Duff, Jacqueline Lovell. That was a very good film, series, whatever you call it, as that film is definitely Charles Band's most underrated film. It is a great film. I loved it so much. It was different from what Full Moon has been offering during the years, whether it's Puppet Master films or Evil Bong films. So I'm really excited for Subspecies 5 Blood Rise. Should know more soon about it. And if I find out, I'll probably talk about it more, since I'm a huge Charles Band fan. In convention news, CT Horror Fest recently announced Shawnee Smith will be coming to the convention. She's been in such films as Saw, Saw 2, Saw 3, and the 1988 remake of The Blob, which is a good film. It's not a great film, but it's a really good film, and it's more darker than the original, which I definitely suggest you check out if you have the time. CT Horror Fest takes place on September 14th in Nantucket, Connecticut. And finally, ScareCon New England just released another big headlining guest for their convention June 7th through the 9th in Framingham, Massachusetts, at the Sheraton Hotel and Conference Center. They are bringing in Billy Zane. He's known for films such as Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight, The Phantom, and also appearing on season 2 of Twin Peaks. Definitely a very good guest for this convention. It's happening June 7th through the 9th in Framingham, Massachusetts, at the Sheraton Hotel and Conference Center. And with that, that's the news. Besides Anthony T's Horror Show, you can also listen to these other fine podcasts on the Doc Discussions Network. Doc Discussions, hosted by Philip Perrone and Michael Darwin. You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast. Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, a Westworld podcast. Halloween Boutique, Psychotronic Reviews. And Searching for American Gods. You can find Doc Discussions on the web at www.docdiscussions.com. And Doc Discussions is also available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm here with Crest Winchester, one of the brain trusts at ScareCon New England, and he's also one of the most recognizable voices that you'll hear at the convention, as you can hear him from all the way down the room, because he also does photos too for the convention.
Hi, what's up, everybody?
Now,
I'm always hollering. It's one of the best parts to get that energy going. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's also one of the things that makes it different from other conventions.
Well, everybody's got to know what's going on, so I like to holler about it. I like to get people involved and get that energy pumping.
Now, how did you become involved with ScareCon?
So I became involved with ScareCon about 5 or 6 years ago. I'm a special effects makeup artist and a horror and fashion and beauty photographer. And I just started working with this company called Spray Blood. And I did an event at a bar where it was Halloween time. I would do special effects makeup on people for their Halloween parties and take a picture and print it out, and they would go right away with it. And that was good for me. And then somebody said, hey, listen, you need to do this at this place called ScareCon. And I'm like, ScareCon, what's that? And, you know, somebody told me what it was, and I checked it all out. And sure enough, I managed to get my way there. And JV, who is, you know, the big brains behind everything, he's the boss, he's the producer, he's the man in charge. He's, of course, he's always busy. He's got so many different things going on. So when he heard about it, he's like, yeah, you can just set up outside, right outside the convention. It's fine. I don't even think he knew what was going on. But I did that. And by catching everybody walking in and walking out, taking photos, we just kind of grew. And I realized how amazing ScareCon is and how it's different from so many other cons, because it's a tight-knit family. It's people who love horror. We all love horror. And, you know, we love it, and it's all part of it. It really becomes this family-knit kind of thing. And I saw the vision that JV had for ScareCon, and I saw what it was and how it could be. And I just came back every year and every year, and ultimately I just wouldn't go away. And I told JV I can definitely help. I definitely want to be involved. And after a lot of hard work and a lot of perseverance, I'm here now helping them with pretty much everything that we can to make ScareCon the best con that's out there.
Now, one of the things that I've noticed from attending the convention here in New England each of the 3 years that ScareCon has been in New England is that I see a lot of podcasters mm-hmm. there. And it is also one of the unique things about this convention. Why does ScareCon focus on podcasters at their convention?
Well, a lot of reasons. But the main reason is podcasters are really the lifeblood and the stitching that keeps the community together. We know that the horror community is a select group of people who love horror. I mean, it's bigger and bigger and bigger. But podcasters, they talk about horror, everything from big-name horror movies to independent horror to different horror actors and guests and so many things that doesn't get enough recognition and enough attention as it deserves. JV, having his background of being a radio host, he knows how important that is, and you guys are the ones that really keep everything connected rather than just, hey, you see this new horror movie, and you guys talk about it all the time. You guys really delve into all of it and talk about the hows and the whys. We, as horror fans, love it all. So those podcasters are the stitching that holds the community together and helps it grow and helps people become connected all over the world by knowing, hey, listen, I love horror too. So that's what podcasters do, and that's why we really, really want to take our hats off to them and say thanks for doing what you do.
Now, ScareCon New England has a great lineup, which I'll talk about in a little with you.
Mm-hmm.
But how did the ScareCon New England Podcast Awards come about?
So JV has had this vision for award ceremonies for exactly just what I said, basically saying, hey, you guys do so much. And there's never even really been any kind of awards for big-name Hollywood horror actors. It's always just been regular mainstream movies, and horror has kind of been put on the back burner. So this is our way to commemorate them, our way to say thank you, our way to say, wow, you guys are great actors. Everything from the makeup that goes into it to the writing, the directing, how it's shot from a mainstream movie. And what we want to do is we want to essentially say thank you and recognize you and give the best of the best and see who's out there and see what to listen to and really help that community, help those people get more followers, you know, keep on doing what they do, keep on putting on their show, give them a reason to continue to connect all these people that they'll never even know sometimes. And that's what's nice about it is you guys have fans all over that you'll probably never even know most of these fans. But by knowing that you're out there and keep on tuning in all the time is what makes it really awesome. And we want to say, hey, you guys are doing a great job. Keep it up.
What kind of podcasts are eligible for these awards?
Well, obviously we want to focus on, you know, the horror and the pop culture podcasts. And those are the ones. I mean, I'm not saying we're going to kick anybody else out, but that's, you know, that's what we're focusing on. Those horror podcasters and those pop culture podcasters.
How does the process work in nominating a podcast on your website?
Sure. So right now, if you or anyone else out there, you know, owns and operates their podcast, I'll go up to the website right in the Podcaster Awards section, and there's a little form that you'll fill out that you can submit yourself and nominate yourself as a podcaster you think you would deserve an award in one of these particular categories. Now, once all that's done, there is a nominating committee that we have where we're all listening to them and trying to find out, you know, the handful of the ones that could be a winner. Anywhere from between 3 and 8, we listen to them, we kind of cut them down. And then I will have a separate set of judges that will judge each individual category based on a certain criteria and determine who the winner is for that category. And, of course, New England, we're going to do this every single year. So our winners, hopefully they can retain their crown or someone else will take it from them.
What are the categories that people can vote on?
Yeah, so there's actually two parts here. There's first off the categories that the podcaster themselves will nominate themselves for each one, and those are the best overall podcast, the best podcast host, the most humorous, the best interview or best guest, our long form and our short form. Now, pretty soon we're going to open it up to our fan favorites, and that's with anybody who listens to the podcast can vote which one they think is just the best, and that's kind of like a separate category. And so one is where the podcasters themselves will nominate. The second one is where their fans will nominate.
One of the things that I've noticed on the site that you just mentioned is a category for best interview or discussion. How does one person fill out a nomination for that category? Because, for example, I can't fill out Anthony T's interview with Maria Olson, for example.
Well, you sure can. And here's how you would do it. You would go into the place where you click submit, and as you go through that form that I have, there's a way that you can link. If you say, I want to nominate this podcast for the best interview with this guest, you would click on that, and then you're going to send a link to that particular episode. So that way we can listen to your podcast and that interview. So you would link the actual episode.
When nominating a podcast, do people have to make sure all the hosts are listed, whether it's for best podcast, most humorous, or just best host?
Well, it kind of depends on what you're going for. So if you're voting, if you're thinking you would be nominated for best host, then obviously you want to put those host names there. But if it's for most humorous and you're just trying to talk about the podcast as a whole, you don't have to. But, of course, we want to give credit to everybody who's involved. But if you don't necessarily put all the host names on there, you're not going to get disqualified. But like I said, we want to make sure that everybody's getting the proper credit that they deserve.
Are these awards only for the New England podcasts? Or can someone, say, from California or way out there in England can enter?
That's the joy of the internet. If you can listen to it online, it can be anywhere. So doesn't matter where the podcast is based out of. It doesn't have to be New England. It can be anywhere in the world.
When does the nominating process end?
So the nominating process ends. We're actually, and you'll see this all over our website and our social media links, we are going to be closing submissions on May 1st. So you can submit all the way up until May 1st. On May 1st, we're going to open it up for fan favorites. So then there's going to be a whole different link and a different a form that you would fill out to say, hey, listen, I listened to this podcast. I think they're great. I want to cast my vote for them. That's coming up quick. So we only got about 2 weeks. If there's anybody out there who you own and operate a podcast and you think you should deserve an award for all the hard work you do, now's the time to head on over to our website, follow that link where it says Podcaster Awards, click submit and put all the information you need in there to put your podcast in there.
Now, what will the winning podcast receive if they win Best Podcast?
There are a lot of different prizes here, and I am under obligation to not be able to go over all those details of the prizes yet. I do know they're pretty awesome. That's as much as I can tell you okay. So far.
Okay, I wouldn't want to.
We don't want to spoil it yet, but that's going to be one of the surprises we're going to let you know soon. But they're awesome. They're awesome prizes, and of course, you got bragging rights to be the number one winner of the best overall podcast in the first ever Podcaster Awards at Scarecon. What I can tell you is each individual category is going to have a really badass trophy that I designed myself, and everybody's going to get a really cool trophy. And be able to hold on to that. So that's pretty cool. Maybe I'll sneak a peek of it on our website or on our Facebook coming up pretty soon.
Do all the nominated podcasts have to attend to receive their
award? We would like you to. Do you have to? No. But we would like, if you're nominated and you want to come and definitely see your competition and also meet your colleagues, you know, because all of these people, if you're all nominated, then you're all doing the right things. You know, you're all out there serving the community. You all love horror. You all want to do all that. So we would like to get you guys together. But, of course, we understand logistically it can't always happen that way. But you're invited to come. We want to see you. You want to sit down in the room. I will be the MC of the Podcaster Awards. So you'll hear me hollering and putting my voice to good use.
Now, has there been a day announced yet when the Scarecon Podcast Awards ceremony will take place?
Now, unofficially, I can tell you that we're looking at Sunday is when this is going to happen. That's Sunday of the con. Now, that could change, so please don't quote me on it. Don't say I'm only going for Sunday. We're just working out basically with the rest of the panels that we have and everything else that will be going on during the convention itself. We're looking at Sunday is going to be our day, but it could change.
Will there be a separate podcast awards for the New York show as well? Or will this be exclusive to the New England show?
We are going to make the Podcaster Awards exclusive only to New England. Now, there will be something special happening for the New York show. And exactly what that is, again, I'm not at liberty to say yet, but it's something really great. It's another way to recognize the staples of the horror community, the things that we all know and love, and maybe some people that deserve recognition that haven't gotten it yet. So that's a little bit of morsels I can give you now. And this is a dream of JV's. It's an idea that he had, and he told me about it a couple times. He's like, "Press, listen, this is something I really want to do. I just don't have the ability to. I need someone to take the reins of it and take control and do that." And I'm here to make his vision real. I want him to sit back and drink a beer and watch it and be proud of what his ideas are.
Now, besides the podcasting awards, what else can people expect at Scarecon New England? As the lineup so far is their best one yet.
Well, I mean, what you can expect at Scarecon New England is a whole lot of fun, number one. I mean, Scarecon is probably one of the best conventions. And I'm not just, you know, saying this because I'm a little biased here, but Scarecon is one of the best conventions I've attended to because we have awesome parties, we have great guests, we have great people. It's a lot of family that come there and people, you know, your con family that you know and you love. What's great about it is everything is all right in the Sheridan Framingham, the convention center, the after parties. All of that are all happening in that same location. So you don't got to worry about driving someplace or going anywhere. It's all in one little spot, which is great. So that's what we're going to have, along with, of course, the other stuff, you know, fantastic vendors, great guests, your celebrity photo ops, your photos to get taken over at my booth, Mr. D Photography booth. So there's a lot of great things to expect at Scarecon.
Tell everyone how they can get tickets for this convention.
I mean, the best and easiest way is right over to the website. Head to the website, click, you know, buy tickets now, and that's where they are, right then and there. So I know I will be making a trip out to Framingham a couple times between now and then, and, you know, I'll be meeting with some business owners, putting up some flyers and some postcards and even some posters. And who knows, there might be some tickets I'll sneak here and there for people to come and get.
Plus, I recommend to everyone to get it on the website before you go to the convention because it's usually a little cheaper than getting it at the door.
And that's kind of, you know, common for any place here. You know, save yourself some money. Besides, you want to save that extra money to spend on stumping out there at the con, not just on your ticket. So get them quick, get them early, get them now. Especially with this lineup, we are we might sell out. So I would you know, be on the safe side and grab them now.
Now, where can they find Scarecon on social media?
And of course, you can go on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, you know, Scarecon or Official Scarecon, and you can find us all there.
And where can they find you on your official website?
The official website is real simple. It's Scarecon.com. We actually just did a lot of work on freshening up our website a little bit. We put some brand new photos on there, photos from past conventions. And we made it a little bit nicer, a little bit more user-friendly than how it has been before in the past years. So definitely go and check it out. If you've been to this website before, go check it out now because it's a little bit different. It's got more and newer stuff on there for you.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you for coming on to my show.
Yeah, absolutely.
And have a good day. And good luck with the
Thanks so much. We'll see you there at Scarecon.
As I can't, I will be there.
All right.
Have a
you
good
too
day.
Now. Bye-bye.
Have a podcast that you want to promote? Well, if you're interested in swapping commercials, you can promote your show here on Anthony T's Horror Show. And in return, I will promote your commercial on my show as well. For more information, contact me at AnthonyT'sHorrorShow@gmail.com.
Hey guys, this is Steven Christina. I'm the founder, owner, creator, and host of Super Retro Throwback Reviews. Are you looking for the best movie reviews, music reviews, video game reviews, and Comic-Con coverage all around? Well, then look no further. Definitely check out Super Retro Throwback Reviews on YouTube and our new audio podcast, the new and improved Super Retro Throwback Reviews Audio Files version 2.0 on the following media distributors: Podbean, Google Play, Stitcher, SoundCloud, iTunes, and Spotify.
Class is over, John. Class is something new and improved.
The following interview or commentary may contain subject matter that may not be suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion advised. Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm here with my guest, Jessica Cameron. She's been in such films as Silent Night, All Through the House, The Sleeper, and most recently, The Song of Solomon and Save Yourself. My first question is, how did you get into acting, producing, and directing?
Well, those are all three different things. So acting, I was in a job in the West years ago, and they had a problem with my speech and insisted I take classes to fix the problem. And when I couldn't find speech classes, my boss at the time, who thought it was ridiculous, but it came from the boss's boss's boss, said, just take an acting class, talk slowly around the stupid people. And that's what I did. And I fell madly in love. And it was the best thing ever because I had realized I was trapped in a career that I didn't love. I loved it in school. I loved it in theory, but I didn't actually love it in practicality. So doing it in real life was very different and I didn't love it. So I was able to just take lots of acting classes and sort of have this passionate, you know, hobby that I felt connected to. And after a couple of years of taking classes, my teachers were like, you're really good. You should start auditioning for real movies. And I was like, well, I don't know. I don't really want to take, I don't really want a second job. And they're like, no. Like, it's this or else you kind of stop because you've taken every class, you know, in the state of Ohio for the most part that's worth taking. So I did, and I just started booking, and I haven't looked back since. And then producing, because I'm naturally a problem solver. My background is in the fashion design world, but all of that meant I had to be incredibly organized, really know my contacts, and specifically as a tech designer at Abercrombie, or I won't say the company, as a tech designer, you're basically just problem solving. So like factories come to you with issues and you're like, how can I solve this problem creatively, ideally with the lowest price point possible? And that's kind of what movie making is. So very quickly I started kind of producing the things that I was in some way a lot of the time, whether I took credit or not as a producer, but directors and teams would come up to me, you know, like, we need a makeup person. Do you know anyone? Do you have this? We need this. Do you know anyone with lights? How much should we spend on lights? That kind of thing. So I started doing it before I started taking credit for it. Because at one time, I didn't want to be considered a hyphenate, meaning an actor slash director slash producer, because I just felt it would weaken my brand as an actor, which I think is now I can look back and say that was incorrect. But at the time, that's where my mind was at. And then directing came in 2013 when I worked on a script that I loved called Truth or Dare. And with that movie, we had a short list of directors that we felt could do it for the budget that we had, which was a very small amount of money. But we really wanted to make sure that we got a director that really understood movie making on a micro scale. And so we had a short list of six. Of those six, three said they would do it, but they had to push the dates that we wanted. They couldn't do it for like 6 months to a year after when we originally wanted to shoot it. And the other three said they would do it if we toned it down, if we let them take a pass at the script to tone it down. So I knew right away I didn't want the script toned down. And then it just came down to, with the investors and everything, if we could push the dates, which we really didn't want to. And in the end, we decided that I was the best fit. The team decided I was the best fit to direct it. And I did. And I really loved the whole process. And it won 34 awards, I think, and screened over 50 festivals across the world. And it was, to this day, one of my favorite experiences in indie film. So from there, I just kept directing.
Now, speaking of extreme horror films, I noticed in your filmography that you've been in such horror films such as Red Eye, The Song of Solomon, and your first directed film, Truth or Dare, which everyone is not the Blumhouse film.
No, thank goodness.
So
it is not.
I figured we just clear that out of the way because that's what people pretty much would think when we were talking about Truth or Dare. Now, what draws you to the extreme side of horror?
I do think it's more fun. So my second film, Mania, that I directed is extremely sexual. So it's extreme in a different kind of way, but it's still very extreme. So I like playing with the extremes because I think it's just, as an independent filmmaker, it's more entertaining for me to go there as a filmmaker, as a storyteller. But then also, because I'm not dealing with a huge team, because I don't have a studio behind me questioning me, telling me I have to tone it down and make it mass marketing, give it mass marketing appeal, I'm able to sort of go to those extreme places because I work with a very small team of people. And usually people I'm working with, my producers, my investors, et cetera, understand like what they're getting when they work with me. So it's not a question of like, we want to alter this or we want to water down you. So I'm really lucky in that sense that I'm able to sort of go to those super, super dark places. And it's kind of where I think I excel the most. My third film, I say it's an intense emotional film. Like, it's probably the most emotional extreme that I'll ever do. And also, like, the least bloody, which in hindsight, at the time, I was really excited to explore it. But I do think, like, for me, I'm like, oh, I don't think it's, like, as much fun to like make. Like, I'm very much a fan of extreme blood, extreme gore, extreme. So it's just, for me, it's a better fit.
Now, you recently had a film come out on DVD called Save Yourself, in which you co-star with Tristan Risk. Tell me about the film and your character.
That film was an interesting experience. I shot it up in Canada. And it was really, 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 really fun to work with a Canadian team. They were really, 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 really nice. So I really loved that. That being said, it wasn't without its challenges. You know, with independent films, a lot of the time, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. You know, one of the obvious issues with that being is I don't think it got released outside of Canada, which kind of sucks. My character was Kim Tobin, who was a sister and the star of various horror films. So it was very appropriate for me to play that role because it was very similar to my life in that regard as far as like her occupation is as an actress in genre films. As she's traveling cross-country with her writer, her director, producer, and sister who also is an actress to go to a film festival screening of their film. And obviously, everything that can't go wrong goes wrong.
What made you want to produce the film as well?
At the time, I really liked the script. I thought it was really, really good. I thought it could be done well for the money that was available. And I was just, I thought that that would be really fun to explore. And I hadn't done a movie, I hadn't produced a movie up in Canada. So I was excited to work with the team on that.
Now, I noticed the film was shot in Oakville, Ontario, Canada.
Oakville.
What was it like shooting there? As the location of the house looked like is located in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, it's very remote. But it's shooting up in small towns in Canada is not dissimilar from shooting small towns in America. They're actually some of my favorite places to shoot because the general population that surrounds you is just so excited to have you there. So it's a very different experience than trying to shoot like in LA where everyone's like, do you have the permit? Do you have this? Do you have that? And nobody's really excited versus when you go to a small town in Canada or America, and I'm sure anywhere else where it's a cool thing, they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. You're making a movie. This is great. So it really helps with the energy on the set.
Now, the film had a tough road getting distribution here in the U.S. as it recently came out a couple of months ago from Animal Content.
Oh, I did. I have to confess, I wasn't even aware that it got released in America.
I got right here, so.
See, you learn something every day. Well, sometimes you're thinking about distribution. It can be hard to, like, get good placement, good timing, good everything. Like, it's just, it's not an easy, simple process, unfortunately, for better or worse.
Yeah, I know. Because you're, I think, having the same problem with your second film as well.
I'm not having a problem, Mania. No. With Mania... Like, here's the thing. People sometimes say that because it takes long from the fan perspective. What the fans don't realize is everything is carefully planned. You just might not like what the plan is, right? So with Mania, it's been signed to a distribution company for over a year. When I sign a distribution deal as a filmmaker, I no longer have rights or a say in what they do. They can literally take up to the duration of their contract, which is a 7-year contract, to release it when it fits their needs. So as a filmmaker, you try to go with the best one possible. So, you know, and again, like I could see like how a fan could think, oh my God, that hasn't come out yet. But realistically, we did 2 years of festivals. We spent 6 months viewing distribution options, signed a deal, and now they're taking whatever time that they want, which in all honesty is perfectly acceptable. And time-wise, that's neither too long. It's not the fastest turnaround, but I mean, I think a 2-year festival run and a 6-month turnaround to a distribution deal is very respectable. So I get like how horror fans sometimes don't quite grasp that part of the business and where they want to see it and they want to see it now. And even like as a filmmaker, sometimes like, oh my God, I just want to release it now. But working with a reputable company that will release it well in their time, I think is crucial to long-term success in the industry, as opposed to like, I'm just going to release it online myself and show it to 500 people. And that's kind of like the lifespan of the film, which I don't think is as productive. With Save Yourself, I think they just didn't have the contacts to the distribution companies they wanted. And I think they had I think certain people involved, they spent a lot of money on post-production, which wasn't planned. So I think when it came time for distribution, with them trying to find a good fit that they would help recoup their costs was a struggle. That combined with larger expectations for what the film would financially provide, I think can often be an issue. So, but even then, like, you know, the fact I wasn't thrilled, obviously, as an actor, you want your work out there. The fact that it came out, you know, probably, what, 2 years ago, I think, in Canada, and now it's finally getting released. I do think it's great that it's finally getting released in America.
Now, you did have the same problem with Truth or Dare, as that kind of sprung out of nowhere.
I mean, again, like you're saying a problem, I wouldn't say that. With Truth or Dare, we shot it in 2013. We did a year and a half post-production, which for a small team, I think that's respectable. We did 2 years of festival runs, right? So that took us to 2017, and then it came out 6 months later. So again, for Truth or Dare, the one thing I did struggle with, although I wouldn't say it's a problem, it's something you just have to sort of work through and find your best option, is finding the right distribution company that wouldn't cut it. Because a lot of people wanted to edit it down to make it more mass consumable. So trying to find a distribution company that would allow me to release the cut as it was in America was hard. So, but that being said, also, it came in Germany before. So some of the extreme fans who really want to see it first could buy the Germany cut. And quite frankly, the Germany cut, I think there's still some limited edition ones available. I'm not sure. They did two different covers. It had so many special features, and it has, like, this beautiful booklet. It's a steel book, they call them. It's really a wonderful collector's item.
Now, you get to work with Tristan Risk on the film, who's been in such films as American Mary and Harvest Lake. What was she like to work with?
I don't have a great working relationship with Tristan. She worked on Mania. I found her to be very difficult to work with. I'm sure she would say the same about me. Some actors can't memorize lines well, and it can be a very big difficult for everybody else on the team. So, you know, I think that that's just sort of one of the many issues that I had with her. So it was definitely a challenge. I can't tell you that I'd work with her again. You know, I think she looks beautiful on camera. I just wish the acting was on par with how she looks.
What was it like working with other cast members like Rye Barnett, Tiana, Nori, and Bobby
Phillips? So Rye Barrett is a wonderfully talented actor who's in Canada. I think he's really, really skilled. I've adored his work before and since working with him. I just think he's very, 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 very good. Technically, practicality, and he's an absolute pleasure to work off of in a scene because he's going to bring 110% to everything he does constantly all the time. Bobby Phillips is somebody who is such a gem. I had not met her prior. She's known in the horror world because obviously she has some wonderful credits to her name. But she's kind of like kept a pretty low profile, you know, since doing these like wonderful movies back in the day. But I really genuinely adored working with her. Again, she was just like one of the nicest people that I've ever, quite frankly, ever had the pleasure to work with. You know, and she shows up, like I said, in like the most random places. She was in Showgirl. She was in like, she's in a lot of these like movies where like, oh, really? Bobby's in that? Huh? Of course she is. So that being said, she was a pleasure to have on set. And then obviously Tiana, who played my sister, was just a doll. I also think she's an amazing actress. I'm a big fan of her entire body of work. Every time I see her do something, I know that it's going to be a really good quality project because she puts her everything into it. She's a consummate professional on set. She, in the movie, to me, plays a character very different than herself in Save Yourself. She's such not that person, and she played that character so well. And she had so much fun getting into that character. It was a real pleasure to not only act opposite of her, but see her enjoy exploring that character, both on screen and off screen.
What was it like working with director Ryan Andrews on the film?
It was good. You know, it was good. Ryan is an interesting character, so he definitely has some wonderful ideas that he puts into his scripts, which I really, really, really genuinely appreciate.
The film has a very dark and kind of gothic look to it. Tell me about the house that was used in the film.
I don't really know that much about it. I wasn't involved really in the location picking of that movie. It's a really cool house. They found it some way or another, and it was really, really fun to shoot there, and it was in a beautiful Oakville, as was mentioned on IMDb.
What was the atmosphere like on set, considering this film has a very dark and creepy tone to it?
Oh, I think like all movies, like the atmosphere on set is not representative of the movie or the content. Typically on genre films, a lot of the people on set love genre films. I will say, like, this crew was absolutely wonderful. So it's just, you know, it's like any other movie set.
What was the most challenging scene in that film that you filmed?
Honestly, I can't even tell you because it was shot so long. Like, I think we shot that in 2014 or 2015. So I don't remember any of the scenes being overly difficult. I remember them all being pretty, like, standard in the shooting.
How long were you on set considering that you produced the film as well?
I was on set for, I believe, 8 or 9 days, which I'm not sure how long the shoot was, but it wasn't very long. So
let's move on to another film that you're recently in called The Song of Solomon, which is a very good film that people should check out.
Yeah.
As I really think this is your best performance yet.
Thank you.
Now, how do you become involved with this film?
So I met Biro at Days of the Dead Atlanta years ago. And when I first met him, it was almost like an instant friendship. So we knew each other online, but we weren't friends. But he was just so nice, and I thought a genuinely good person, that we became friends very quickly. Literally, like, kind of over that weekend, I ended up spending a lot of time hanging out at his table, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he was just really, really wonderful. And at the time, he had told me about this exorcism script. And I'd been itching to do an exorcism movie. I had not done an exorcism movie up until that point in my career. And I also, as a fan of genre films, I felt that we hadn't seen a darker, deeper version sort of The Exorcist in the indie world. And I felt that we were ready to see that, and I would be honored to be involved. So he did tell me about the story and the character, and straight up he was like, you don't really fit the character. I was like, well, why not? You know, and essentially because he wanted like a small town sort of looking girl that was more generic. So I was like, well, I can dye my hair. I don't have to wear makeup. And, you know, I'm not somebody who has to look pretty for the film. You know, I just have to know what I'm getting into and then do it the best that I can. So he was very hesitant to audition me because I wasn't how he saw the character. But I kind of kept begging and told him, like, hey, look, even though we're friends now, you know, if you don't take me, that's fine. You know, as a genre fan, I'm always very much aware that the best person should get the role, in my humble opinion. So that being said, I asked him if I could audition, and he did say I could. And then I auditioned, and I booked it.
What were your first thoughts when you read that script?
I thought it was really... So, several thoughts. My first thought was, man, this is a short script. Because it wasn't very long. Because he didn't, like, draw out a lot of the stuff. He was like, no, I know how I'm going to shoot it, so I know that it's going to be 90 minutes. But that's very atypical, right, in my world. Very atypical. Normally what happens is you get a script and it's like somewhere between 85 and 100 pages. So I first thought that. And then I also thought it's so original. I haven't seen anything like this. It's different from The Exorcist. It's bringing different elements to the table, which I thought was really cool because I'm a big fan of, if somebody else has done it, let them stay doing it. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to, you know, redo it per se. And I really like The Exorcist even today. I think it holds up really well. So I didn't want to do, like, you know, a movie that was just copying it. So I felt that it brought enough new elements and cool things to the table. And I was also really impressed with how he utilized historical accuracy inside of the script. And I thought that was a really unique feature. And I felt it was something that made this one really stand out.
Now, what preparation did you do before taking this role? Because the role really looked challenging with all the movements and everything that your character does in the film.
I told him my inspiration for the movie, which was sort of like a cat and demons and a disregard for my human form, right? Because I'm possessed. So the demon and the body have to be two very separate things, right? The demon's going to sit and do things that might not feel good or like look elegant because they don't care. You know, it's the demon mindset is very much like, how can I get from A to B the quickest and the easiest? Like, how can I get what I want? So it's not about like sitting comfortably or like maintaining good posture. None of that stuff the demon gives a shit about, right? So I just really focused on trying to make sure that like I sort of kept that part of my head, my brain separate, knowing that the demon who's inhabiting my body at this moment doesn't really care. So the demon's either manipulating the body for self-gain or using it to get from point A to point B. And when it's using it to get to point A to point B, I felt it needed to almost be a little bit cat-like, because I just find cats are by far the sleekest, quickest, you know, stealthiest sort of little, you know, creatures that we have a reference to, or at least that I have a reference to.
Who was working with Stephen Biro on the film?
Stephen Biro. So Stephen Biro was a great, great pleasure to work with. He's one of those directors where he really... thinks that he really focuses on hiring the best quality people, then he kind of lets you do what you want. Even there's a scene where I had to sing the Song of Solomon, which is a song that does not have any trace of ever having been recorded because it's supposed to like do a whole bunch of bad stuff. In short, you're not supposed to sing it publicly. So I could find the words, but I couldn't find any notes onto the melody. And everywhere I went was like, do not sing this, do not do it. So I really had a lot of freedoms, and I asked Biro, and for the record, his name's actually Biro, but I've been calling him Biro for years. It's just stuck. So even though I know now that his name is Biro, I always call him Biro. That being said, I spoke to him and I said, hey, look, I have some ideas, but would you like to hear them in advance, or do you want me just to do it on the day of, and we can kind of see what you like best? I'm pretty confident you're going to like, I have three options. I'm really confident that you're going to like one of them. In fact, I think you're really going to love the one that I love. And he was like, let's hold it and just surprise me on the day. So that's what we did. And he's just that kind of director where he's like, no, I'm going to see what you do. I hired you because you're good. Let's see where it goes from there. And then I'll tweak as necessary. So
one of the things I was amazed about that film was the fact that all the priests in the film had a different personality to them. Sometimes in films, a certain type of role where multiple people play kind of the same character, it can feel redundant, but it really doesn't in this film. What was it like working with each of the actors who played the priest in the film?
So, obviously, Gene and David McMahon were wonderful, and I really loved working with them. Gene is one of those actors that caught me off guard. He's a musician by trade. He's in a heavy metal or band, and I'm probably not saying the classification right. It's not my favorite kind of music. I don't listen to it that often, so I'm not the most educated, so my apologies if you're a fan. But his band is really talented, as is he. So I knew him, and I had a great appreciation for his music, before working with him and seeing him on set, I just felt he brought so much instinctively to the table. Like, that man is just a natural. You know, they say like some people just naturally are able to act wonderful. He's one of those people where it's just a natural talent, in my humble opinion. And he was really open. There was times like where he was like, we all struggled with the Latin and some of the dialogue because it's hard. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, to speak another language and memorize pages and pages and pages of dialogue. So I was like showing him like what I do and how I do it. And he was just so kind and so thankful and appreciative. And it really, I think, helped. But he also, like, he had no ego. So there was no like, I know what I'm doing, I've done this. He was like, no, let me try. This is hard. Let me try what you're doing. And he was just lovely to work with, a really giving actor. David was also a pleasure to have on set, and a real joy to work with. Jim Van Bauer was not. He was very difficult. I don't like him as a person. I like him even less on a film set. He was drunk some of the time, and it was just not a pleasure to be even near him in any capacity. And I also felt that he was very disrespectful to the director, the cast, and the crew. So I definitely will not work with him again, at least not in a capacity where I have a scene with him. If he's in the movie and it's not my movie, and I don't have to act opposite of him, then that's fine. But certainly I don't think I'll ever act opposite with him again, because he was just, in my humble opinion, too difficult, too drunk. And there's nothing worse, like, right, when you're giving your best performance and you've got this, you know, actor who's clearly had way too much to drink, who can't memorize his lines, who's just overstepping your lines, and, you know, you're giving a good performance and really giving it your all, and somebody else is just drunkenly stepping on it for no reason, ruining your take. Like, it's really offensive and unneeded.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
So that was, you know,
not like being a cult legend.
Like, and here's the thing, like, everyone speaks about, like, his alcohol problems and stuff. And it's all very true. You know, everything people say, you know, I saw that. I thought he would be professional, or at least bare minimum professional expectations on set. And I was greatly let down. I do think his performance in the movie is good. I think Byro did a wonderful job editing, like Byro and his editor did a really good job at making him look better than the performance that I saw when I was working with him. And I don't feel like they were able to make it work for the film.
There were a lot of very bloody and gruesome effects on this film, including a scene that you're involved in that is very gruesome. That I'm not going to spoil
all of them, pretty much.
I'm talking, all right, I'll spoil the scene in particular, the vomit scene.
Oh, the vomit scene. What I think anybody who's a fan of indie films has by this point heard, or, you know what I mean? Cause, like, it's made the press and like pretty much every reviewer comments on that one way or the other.
Yeah, that was a crazy scene. Now, what was some of the makeup process that you had to go through for that scene?
For that, like, so the makeup for this movie was intense. It was a lot. Every day, hours of makeup, and then throughout the day, hours of touch up. One of the other difficulties was like the contact lenses, which there are several days like where the contacts just would pop out and refuse to go back in. Scholars and full eye contact lenses just sort of are a little bit temperamental, but it's really frustrating, like, as a performer, if you're like on hour 13 and you're like really in it, to have like your contact lens that just won't go in is a nightmare. That day in particular, the hardest thing about that was just, well, I mean, here's the thing. So in the scene, I obviously vomit up a bunch of stuff. And then I decided I'm going to ingest it back down. It's like a power play from the demon, which, by the way, I thought was a brilliant, brilliant power moment for the demon character. And I thought it was really original for Steven to put it in there, you know, because it was just him showing his power. Like, I can literally kill this girl instantly, and I can let her live a little longer, and it's all a sport to me, and I'm just doing it to get a reaction out of you. I thought it was really brilliant. And I told them, so he warned me how we were going to do it, which is, the team, particularly Jeremy Cruz, who's a talented effects artist, had made all of these prop guts, and they were squishy, and they were mostly hollow, right? So they could fold down smaller, and they would, like, balloon out, so to speak. And they were just like, how much do you think you can fit down? And I was like, here's the thing. I don't want to try now, because I'm going to be able to fit however amount in my mouth and, like, vomit them up. it's not going to change, right? Like, it's not a skill set where it's like, if I practice doing this, I'm going to be, no, like, it's going to be whatever it's going to be. So I told them, so I made like a note of my script. I was like, don't eat on this day, because I wanted to vomit up the least amount in real life, because I thought it would just make everything worse. So I knew that I wasn't going to eat that day until after this was over. And then, of course, you don't feel like eating, which is the irony. And I'm not saying this is the best way to do it for everyone. Obviously, wonderful people listening, you should eat and drink regularly like humans, but sometimes the role does require you to go outside your box. So I didn't eat that day. And I told them, like, my biggest thing is let's make sure we set up the shot how we like it, because I want to do this as few times as possible. I want to do it as much as you need to get the shot you need, but I don't want it to be like, oh, we don't really love that shot. Let's just, no, let's spend the time in the beginning. Let's do that. And then also, nobody should cut but me. If I'm doing it right, everybody on set is going to be like, oh my God, that looks horrifying. Like, oh my God, you must be in pain, or that hurts, or ah, don't do it. I was like, so I want everyone to stay quiet. I will call cut. I will stop what I've done. Like, I literally just don't want anyone to interrupt this, because I want to have to do it as least as possible. I'm going to bring it 110%. Just, you bring the camera, you copy it. And I think we did it twice. And they were like, oh my God, that's horrifying. I was like, yeah, I know, right? And I literally just tried to fit as much as I could down my throat with vomiting the least, and then just sort of went for it, you know, with a complete disregard, like trying to disconnect the physical discomfort from the performance. Because, again, like my character, which is the demon, right? Like, I'm not playing Mary, I'm playing the demon that's possessing Mary. The demon doesn't feel any of those things. Like, it doesn't feel discomfort. It doesn't feel pain. It doesn't feel any of those things. So it was really important that, like, I didn't play into those feelings. So just sort of a full disconnect.
Was this the most difficult scene that you filmed on the Song of Solomon?
You know what? Probably. Like, keep in mind, it wasn't the... Physically, it's not the... Like, it's probably the physically the most difficult film I've done as a whole. So, you know what? Like, it's hard to say, because, like, Day two, I think, the first day that we had in the wooden bed. So in the opening of the film, I'm actually on a really nice, soft, cushiony bed. And as things start to go wrong, they replace the bed with a wooden bed so that they can shift the parts, right? That made everything for my character a lot more uncomfortable. So, and it's one of the things that you don't realize how uncomfortable it is, like, to just be basically tied to a very hard, flat, uncushioned surface for, like, an extended period of time. But it gets very uncomfortable. That being said, the first day that they brought in the wooden bed and they assembled it, I had to have these, like, Scolaris contact lenses in. And what I didn't realize at the time, so they built the bed outside and then they brought it in pieces and assembled it. And when you do that, you're filling the air with all these little itty-bitty microscopic bits of basically sawdust. So the first day that was in, my eyes were in so much pain, like, viciously on fire. And that was probably the most painful part of shooting for me, was the first day that we did it with all the sawdust in the air, because it just felt like my eyes had 1,000 needles on them. Like, and it was incredibly, incredibly, incredibly painful. I haven't experienced that kind of pain before or since on a set. And again, it's like one of those things where there's not a lot that you could do other than just work through it, because nobody had planned for this. I mean, in hindsight, now I know next time if I ever wear Scolarises, I'll make sure that, like, any construction is completed several days before I have to shoot. Because, again, like, those little micro, it's really, really incredibly painful. And they just sort of, like, absorb, like, get stuck to the content. It was really a nightmare. So that, for me, was probably the hardest day on set. Not the vomit scene, ironically enough.
Now, what was your thoughts after seeing that film?
It was funnier than I thought while filming it. I didn't see the humor. Now, keep in mind, the humor typically comes in the scenes that I'm not in. So I also wasn't present for a lot of those. It was one of those shoots where, because I had so much Latin, I had so much Bible phrases that had to be, like, memorized perfectly but come across organic when I said them, that I spent most of my spare time either befriending the stray dog who had become the love of my life, who I named Solomon, or just working through all my dialogue. I wasn't, like, sitting around on set on the scenes that I was in, because I felt that I had so much other things I had to do with my time. But I was really impressed. You know, I think what Biro did with such a small group of people is really phenomenal. And I was really blown away.
Now, we mentioned Mania a little bit earlier in the interview. Tell me about that film? And what was it like to work with Ellie Church on that
film? So Mania is my fucked up lesbian love story, and I'm really, really, really proud of it. I think we ended our festival run with 37 screenings and 23 awards, something like that. I didn't put in as much time in the festival run as I did for Truth or Dare because I wanted to push to get to a distribution company quicker. That being said, I'm really happy overall. Certainly filming that film was a difficult choice because we filmed it cross country. So that led to a bunch of wonderful things happening and also extra difficulties, some of which we saw and some of which we didn't. We did video that whole process, which is in Kill the PA, which has become a bit bigger of a project since doing that. Working with Ellie was interesting. She's somebody who had basically done films as a hobby. She's a bartender by trade. And I think she's a really skilled actress. I would be really interested to see what she could do if she actually just tried to do it full time. Because I think she's really just very naturally gifted. And she looks beautiful on screen. So there's also some other actors that I love in that movie as well. Becca Moore, who is quite wonderful and talented. I've been a fan of for many, many years. I met her on the first set I ever worked on, a little show called Two Doors Down. And I knew that I always, anytime she'd been anything, I wanted to hire her because she was just so fantastic. And some of the other characters I think are really, really great and really, really original.
Okay, let's skip the next question because I had DVD and VOD status, but you told me it's in the hands of a distributor.
Yeah, so we're just waiting for them to get the details and then I'll give it to you.
You also have a third film that you direct.
I do, an ending, which is in final stages of post-production. I'm literally just dealing with my lovely composer, who's very talented, James Dahl, at the moment. So that'll hopefully be hitting festivals later on this year, and then distribution shortly after.
You also have a popular YouTube channel as well called Scream Queen Stream, which has over 1,000 subscribers. How did your channel get started?
So with Scream Queen Stream, I knew I wanted to do something horror and genre related, and it kind of took a different turn instantly. When we first started doing it, I originally started with Heather Dorf, who's my dear friend. So she's still my friend, but she's no longer really involved in the channel. Originally it was supposed to be horror genre and indie, and then it kind of veered off into just us having fun. So I am trying to bring it back to horror genre indie because it's basically my way of giving back to the horror community that has been so kind to me. So I knew I wanted to do something that I had more control over. We talked earlier about distribution and how, as a filmmaker, you don't really have much control. You go with the best deal that you can and you hope they don't screw you over. They hope you pay you on time and you hope they release it sooner rather than later. And you hope they market it. You hope they do all these things. But as a filmmaker, you don't really have control over that. So I knew I wanted to figure out a way how I could push content out regularly to the fans, to the people that support me, to the people who are interested and passionate about the same kind of things that I am, in a way that I had full control, in a way that I wasn't dependent upon a third party to make sure it got out there, the way that I am with films. So for me, that's exactly what YouTube is. It's my way to control my content. And it's been a really, really wonderful, very self-fulfilling journey. And I'm really, really loving it. This year, I really doubled down and focusing on trying to bring light to filmmakers and actors that I admire and respect, to still keep the fun up, to bring the audience on board with a lot of the fun, cool things LA has to offer, which I think is unfair. It's not great that not everybody has access to these things. So my goal is to try to share. So if you don't have access to that panel at First Glance Film Festival, don't worry, I got you. I'm going to film it, I'm going to edit it, and I'm going to share it with you. So it's like you were there, even though you weren't. Or you can't get to that cool movie premiere. Don't worry, I got you. I'm going to film it, and I'm going to try to edit it and do it in a way that hopefully you can sort of be a part of the experience, even though time and money might have prevented you from actually being there.
What was your favorite interview so far on the channel?
My favorite interview? That's tricky because they're all so special to me. I would say one of my all-time favorite people is Dell, who runs Dark Dells, which is in Burbank. And I knew he was the first person I wanted to do a serious sit-down interview with when I sort of redirected the channel back to indie and back to horror. And I knew that I wanted to interview him because I just find him to be such a wonderful, fascinating person. And he's done so much for the horror community here in LA. And I knew that his retail store, Dark Delicacies, was struggling. They were trying to kick up the rent. They are trying to kick out all the cool, unique little shops in the area that he's in. which is kind of horror alley for us. Those of us who live in LA, it's in Burbank, and there's like a bunch of horror stores, and everything's kind of trying to go mainstream and charge a lot more rent than is sustainable by a little horror, you know, bookstore or novelty store. It's also where the horror community gathers for signings, etc., which, by the way, Dell doesn't even charge a fee for that because he just wants to give back. So I knew that I wanted to interview him to share his story with a wider amount of people and hopefully remind people that even if they're not local, they can still support this place, you know. And the other thing that I love about Dark Dells is when they do these signings, which they do pretty much every week, they do multiple signings. So you can get like a signed disc and it's the same price. It's the MSRP that it is with all the signatures, and you can order from them and just pay shipping. So if you're a fan of signed merch, which I obviously as a horror fan am, it's a really great way for you to get like that cool film that you want to watch anyways for the same price you would pay in a store, but you pay shipping and then you get like seven signatures on it. Like, that's rad. So being able to sort of share that with a wider group of people was really, 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 really great.
That's why I love going to horror conventions. Right? You get to meet very nice people.
I love horror conventions, but also that comes with it a financial expense, right? Like, not everybody has the money to travel to, stay over, and even then you're paying $20 plus per signature, you know, or you can pay attention to the Dark Dells website, and when they do a signing, order one from them. You pay, you know, I don't even know what shipping is. I have to assume it's $5 or $6. I always go in person, so I don't know what the shipping is. But you just pay shipping and you get all the signatures.
Now, are you surprised that the channel has hit over 1,000 subscribers?
No, I am not surprised about that at all, because I think, you know, in my world, I love horror, and I think other people do too, you know, and they love seeing people just have fun. I was surprised, like, when we got over 50,000 views. That was for me. I'm like, oh, wow, people are watching this. That's pretty neat. You know, 50,000 views is a lot of views. So for me, that was sort of like the cool, interesting sort of new thing.
Yeah, I also have a YouTube channel for the show, and it's like struggling. Then I started ranting about Child's Play remake, and apparently people will view that. I wish they would view more of my independent content, but still, it can be tough trying to get to run a YouTube channel.
Well, I think like the trick that I learned really quickly, because I have another channel that I do that's completely not horror related, but it's like something else I love, which is just like makeup and beauty and skincare and all that stuff. Consistency is key. So you need to sort of set a schedule and you need to share it actively. So for me, what I'm trying to do is like every Wednesday and ideally Friday-ish videos go public. You know, and sometimes there's even a third video. So it's trying to be consistent to that, because that's really what helped the channel grow. And I think what's going to help the future of the channel grow.
Your show also has a Patreon account for expenses. Tell everyone about it and how.
Absolutely. So if you just go to Patreon, you can check out Scream Queen Stream. You could join for as little as $1 a month. You can get access to early footage. You get the links to the private videos. So I'm trying to right now make 3 private videos just for the Patreon that never go public. You get access to Google Hangouts, signed giveaways, and other cool, interesting merch. So you can go check out the Patreon where you can get that, and you can do it for as little as $1 a month. Obviously, there's like other tiers. How Patreon works is you select the tier that fits your budget, and then you go to that. So definitely check it out. I would love to have you there.
Finally, any upcoming projects that people should keep an eye out for, either on DVD, VOD, or on the film festival circuit?
Well, definitely check. I'm going to probably change the title of an ending because I don't really love the title. I'm not really sure what I'm going to change it to yet. But stay tuned for more updates on that. I'm really, really excited, and I can't wait to share that one with you guys. Mania, like I said, we should be announcing the release hopefully sooner than later. And other than that, I'm not really sure what I'm going to shoot next as a director. I've got several projects at script stage, same with producing. So just pay attention to my social pages and you'll see that. As an actress, I've got too many films in post, but I'm not sure which one will finish, which one won't. Certainly The Tombs should be making its premiere later on this year, which I got to be the really fun horror host of an English show that we shot in the UK, which was super fun and such a great project. I shot a wonderful, talented Stephen King adapted short called The Rest Stop, which I know is going to start making the rounds this year. I did a Sasquatch movie, which I keep on hoping it's going to get released sometime in the very near future. And then there's several other projects, which, like I said, just stay tuned and I'll share with the details when I have them.
Now, where can they find you on the web and social media?
Well, I love social media. So obviously on YouTube, I'm at Scream Queen Stream and Wannabe Beauty Guru. Those are my two main channels. I do have an actor channel if you want to see like old audition stuff. That's just Jessica Cameron. Then on Instagram, I'm at Actress Jessica Cameron. On Twitter, I'm at Jessica Cameron _. And on Facebook, the fan page is just under Jessica Cameron.
Thank you very much for coming on my show, Jessica. Have a good
pleasure.
Day.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. Have a good day and good luck with upcoming projects.
Thanks.
Want to learn more about horror directors? With a lighthearted look at three of their movies? Meet fearless podcaster Gore Blimey.
I've been unsettled by bats in the past and startled by parrots, and I've even been known to jump at the odd cockatoo.
Discover horror films that are classics, and others, too.
There's a topless aerobics massacre, an exploding rock singer, cannibals, nude martial arts, a deep-fried prostitute.
But it's not all silliness. You'll get proper movie breakdowns, opinion, and background information, too.
Yep, in the 80s and 90s, Jeff Stryker was huge in gay porn. In every sense.
So if you're a horror film fan, come and check out the Trilogy of Terror podcast at strangeanddeadly.com or find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or on your podcatcher.
One of those people that has a certain charisma and a certain style, and I'm just hoping one day he'll rub off on me.
The Trilogy of Terror podcast, where we try three times harder to give you the willies.
You can find Anti-T's Horror Show on social media on these platforms. Facebook at facebook.com/Anti-T's Horror Show. Twitter at www.twitter.com/Anti-T's Horror. On Instagram at www.instagram.com/Anti-T's Horror Show. On YouTube at www.youtube.com/AnthonyThurber. And you can find Anthony T's Horror Show on the web as well at anthonytshorrorshow.blogspot.com. And you can also find Doc Discussions at www.docdiscussions.com. Welcome back to Anthony T's Horror Show. Now I'm here with my film recommendation for this episode. And I'm going to recommend a film that basically Joe Bob Briggs hated. It was the first episode of The Last Drive-In, which can be seen on Shudder every Friday night. And on demand. Definitely a good show, check it out. But I have this problem with the way Joe Bob Briggs had with his criticism of the film. First, I respect his criticism of any film, but I don't know why he was so negative about Chud. Really. Whether it's the opening on The Last Drive-In where he complained about the shower scene. Well, every horror film does not need a shower scene. It's more about storytelling, not oh, how many shower scenes we can put in. Or how every film needs a main character. Hello, Joe Bob. Chud is more of an ensemble film than a regular horror film. It relies basically more on the story at hand in the situation. But I don't get why Joe Bob really slammed this film. Because this is a very good film. One of the things that makes Chud very good was the way the script was written. I like the fact that this film had different points of view. It made the main situation in the film interesting. You can't have all films have a simple story and lead character. Some films are meant to be ensemble films. Chud is one of them. Another thing I liked about Chud was the performances in the film. As I thought, Daniel Stern, Christopher Curry, and the late John Hurd. Their performances in this film were very good. And it helped really drive home the film for me. Another thing that really makes this film good was the fact that it builds to eventually seeing the monsters or building some tension, especially towards the last third of the film. It is done in a way that is very good and makes this film very entertaining. A couple of interesting facts about this film were that I found out through research. It also has brief appearances from John Goodman, who everyone knows from The Conners most recently, and 10 Cloverfield Lane. Patricia Richardson, who is most notably known for playing Tim Allen's wife on the 90s sitcom Home Improvement. And you have also a list of really good character actors as well, including the late Michael O'Hara, who was Commander Jeffrey Sinclair on Babylon 5, which was created by the late Gene Roddenberry. You had the late J. Thomas, who won 2 Emmys for his guest star work on the 90s sitcom Murphy Brown, and the late John Polito, who appeared in various Coen brother films, like The Man Who Wasn't There, The Big Lebowski. He also appeared in The Crow as well back in 1994. He was more of a character actor, but you recognized him in a lot of stuff in the 90s. So I would definitely recommend you check out Chud. It's a very good film. And don't listen to what Joe Bob Briggs says about this film, because this is a very good ensemble film. I only wished Chud 2 was like that, because they could have done something with the Chud franchise. Instead, they made Chud 2, got out of the streets of New York, and look what happened. That film was a total disaster, but it still ranks as like a guilty pleasure film. So you could probably do without Chud 2, but definitely rent or see Chud. I know it's on Shudder. You can also listen to Joe Bob Briggs' take on the film, which I don't agree with, but I respect. This is why I'm recommending Chud on this edition. On Anthony T's Horror Show on YouTube, I have a couple new videos out. First, I debut a new segment on the YouTube channel called Anthony T Uncensored. In the first video, I talk about how Instagram is censoring hashtag horror. I think it's wrong, but I'm going to save that for the YouTube. So go over to Anthony T's Horror Show's YouTube channel to hear my thoughts on that. I also have an edition of Anthony T's Horror Collection up on Anthony T's Horror Show's YouTube channel, which I showcase some of the recent horror pickups that I have. And you can also check out my infamous Child's Play rant on the YouTube channel as well, where I talk about how Mark Hamill is not my Chucky. I'm sorry, I like Mark Hamill, but there's only one Chucky in my opinion, and it's Brad Dourif. You can check everything out over at youtube.com/AnthonyThurber. That's T-H-U-R-B-E-R. And please subscribe, as I'm looking to get to 100 subscribers so I can make the page the show page. So don't forget to subscribe. That's it for this edition of Anthony T's Horror Show. I'm Anthony T. Have a good day. Hashtag horror is healthy. And support indie horror.